Chapter 9. The Outrage. A beautiful starlit night had followed on the day of incessant rain, a cool, balmy, late summer's night, essentially English in its suggestion of moisture and scent of wet earth and dripping leaves. The magnificent coach, drawn by four of the finest thoroughbreds in England, had driven off along the London road, with Sir Percy Blakeney on the box holding the reins in his slender, feminine hands, and beside him Lady Blakeney wrapped in costly furs. A 50-mile drive on a starlit summer's night. Marguerite had hailed the notion of it with delight. Sir Percy was an enthusiastic whip. His four thoroughbreds, which had been sent down to Dover a couple of days before, were just sufficiently fresh and restive to add zest to the expedition, and Marguerite revelled in anticipation of the few hours of solitude, with the soft night breeze fanning her cheeks, her thoughts wandering whither away. She knew from old experience that Sir Percy would speak little, if at all. He had often driven her on his beautiful coach for hours at night, from point to point, without making more than one or two casual remarks upon the weather or the state of the roads. He was very fond of driving by night, and she had very quickly adopted his fancy. As she sat next to him, hour after hour, admiring the dexterous, certain way in which he handled the reins, she often wondered what went on in that slow-going head of his. He never told her, and she had never cared to ask. At the Fisherman's Rest, Mr. Jellyband was going the round, putting out the lights. His bar customers had all gone, but upstairs, in the snug little bedrooms, Mr. Jellyband had quite a few important guests. The Comtesse de Tournay, with Suzanne and the Vicomte, and there were two more bedrooms ready for Sir Andrew Ffoulkes and Lord Anthony Dewhurst, if the two young men should elect to honour the ancient hostelry and stay the night. For the moment, these two young gallants were comfortably installed in the coffee-room, before the huge log fire which, in spite of the mildness of the evening, had been allowed to burn merrily. "I say, Jelly, has everyone gone?" asked Lord Tony, as the worthy landlord still busied himself clearing away glasses and mugs.
"Everyone, as you see, my lord."
"And all your servants gone to bed?"
"All except the boy on duty in the bar, and," added Mr. Jellyband with a laugh, "I expect he'll be asleep before long, the rascal."
"Then we can talk here undisturbed for half an hour?"
"At your service, my lord. I leave your candles on the dresser, and your rooms are quite ready. I sleep at the top of the house myself, but if your lordship will only call loudly enough, I dare say I shall hear."
"All right, Jelly. And, I say, put the lamp out. The fire will give us all the light we need, and we don't want to attract the passer-by."
"All right, my lord."
Mr. Jellyband did as he was bid. He turned out the quaint old lamp that hung from the raftered ceiling, and blew out all the candles.
"Let's have a bottle of wine, Jelly," suggested Sir Andrew.
"All right, sir."
Jellyband went off to fetch the wine. The room now was quite dark, save for the circle of ruddy and fitful light formed by the brightly blazing logs in the hearth.
"Is that all, gentlemen?"
asked Jellyband, as he returned with a bottle of wine and a couple of glasses, which he placed on the table.
"That'll do nicely, thanks, Jelly," said Lord Tony. "Good night, my lord."
"Good night, sir."
"Good night, Jelly."
The two young men listened whilst the heavy tread of Mr. Jellyband was heard echoing along the passage and staircase. Presently even that sound died out, and the whole of the Fisherman's Rest seemed wrapped in sleep, save the two young men drinking in silence beside the hearth. For a while no sound was heard, even in the coffee-room, save the ticking of the old grandfather's clock and the crackling of the burning wood.
"All right again this time, folks?" asked Sir Anthony at last.
Sir Andrew had been dreaming, evidently, gazing into the fire, and seeing therein no doubt a pretty piquant face, with large brown eyes and a wealth of dark curls round a childish forehead.
"Yes,"
he said, still musing.
"All right."
"No hitch?"
"Oh, none."
Lord Antony laughed pleasantly as he poured himself out another glass of wine.
"I need not ask, I suppose, whether you found the journey pleasant this time?"
"No, friend, you need not ask," replied Sir Andrew gaily. "It was all right."
"Then here's to her very good health," said jovial Lord Tony. "She's a bonny lass, though she is a French one. And here's to your courtship. May it flourish and prosper exceedingly."
He drained his glass to the last drop, then joined his friend beside the hearth.
"Well, you'll be doing the journey next, Tony, I expect," said Sir Andrew, rousing himself from his meditations.
You and Hastings, certainly, and I hope you may have as pleasant a task as I had, and as charming a travelling companion. You have no idea, Tony.
No, I haven't, interrupted his friend pleasantly, but I'll take your word for it. And now, he added, whilst a sudden earnestness crept over his jovial young face, how about business?
The two young men drew their chairs closer together, and instinctively, though they were alone, their voices sank to a whisper.
"I saw the Scarlet Pimpernel alone for a few moments in Calais," said Sir Andrew, "a day or two ago. He crossed over to England 2 days before we did. He had escorted the party all the way from Paris, dressed, you'll never credit it, as an old market woman, and driving, until they were safely out of the city, the covered cart, under which the Comtesse de Tournay, Mademoiselle Suzanne, and the Vicomte lay concealed among the turnips and cabbages. They themselves, of course, never suspected who their driver was. He drove them right through a line of soldiery and a yelling mob who were screaming, 'A bas les aristos!' But the market cart got through, along with some others, and the Scarlet Pimpernel in shawl, petticoat, and hood yelled, 'A bas les aristos!' louder than anybody. Faith, added the young man as his eyes glowed with enthusiasm for the beloved leader, that man's a marvel. His cheek is preposterous, I vow, and that's what carries him through.
Lord Antony, whose vocabulary was more limited than that of his friend, could only find an oath or two with which to show his admiration for his leader.
He wants you and Hastings to meet him at Calais, said Sir Andrew more quietly, on the 2nd of next month. Let me see, that will be next Wednesday.
Yes.
It is, of course, the case of the Comte de Tournay this time. A dangerous task, for the Comte, whose escape from his chateau after he had been declared a suspect by the Committee of Public Safety, was a masterpiece of the Scarlet Pimpernel's ingenuity, is now under sentence of death. It will be rare sport to get him out of France, and you will have a narrow escape if you get through at all. Saint-Just has actually gone to meet him. Of course, no one suspects Saint-Just as yet. But after that, to get them both out of the country... Faith, 'twill be a tough job, and tax even the ingenuity of our chief. I hope I may yet have orders to be of the party.
Have you any special instructions for me?
Yes, rather more precise ones than usual. It appears that the Republican government have sent an accredited agent over to England, a man named Chauvelin, who is said to be terribly bitter against our league and determined to discover the identity of our leader, so that he may have him kidnapped the next time he attempts to set foot in France. This Chauvelin has brought a whole army of spies with him, and until the chief has sampled the lot, he thinks we should meet as seldom as possible on the business of the League, and on no account should talk to each other in public places for a time. When he wants to speak to us, he will contrive to let us know. The two young men were both bending over the fire, for the blaze had died down, and only a red glow from the dying embers cast a lurid light on a narrow semicircle in front of the hearth. The rest of the room lay buried in complete gloom. Sir Andrew had taken a pocket-book from his pocket, and drawn therefrom a paper which he unfolded, and together they tried to read it by the dim red firelight. So intent were they upon this, so wrapped up in the cause, the business they had so much at heart, so precious was this document which came from the very hand of their adored leader, that they had eyes and ears only for that. They lost count of the sounds around them, of the dropping of crisp ash from the grate, of the monotonous ticking of the clock, of the soft, almost imperceptible rustle of something on the floor close beside them. A figure had emerged from under one of the benches. With snake-like, noiseless movements it crept closer and closer to the two young men, not breathing, only gliding along the floor in the inky blackness of the room. "You are to read these instructions and commit them to memory," said Sir Andrew, "then destroy them." He was about to replace the letter-case into his pocket when a tiny slip of paper fluttered from it and fell onto the floor. Lord Antony stooped and picked it up.
"What's that?" he asked.
"I don't know," replied Sir Andrew.
"It dropped out of your pocket just now. It certainly did not seem to be with the other paper."
"Strange. I wonder when it got there."
"It is from the chief," he added, glancing at the paper. Both stooped to try and decipher this last tiny scrap of paper, on which a few words had been hastily scrawled, when suddenly a slight noise attracted their attention, which seemed to come from the passage beyond.
"What's that?" said both instinctively.
Lord Antony crossed the room towards the door, which he threw open quickly and suddenly. At that very moment he received a stunning blow between the eyes, which threw him back violently into the room. Simultaneously, the crouching, snake-like figure in the gloom had jumped up and hurled itself from behind upon the unsuspecting Sir Andrew, felling him to the ground. All this occurred within the short space of 2 or 3 seconds, and before either Lord Antony or Sir Andrew had time or chance to utter a cry or to make the faintest struggle, they were each seized by 2 men. A muffler was quickly tied round the mouth of each, and they were pinioned to one another back to back, their arms, hands, and legs securely fastened. One man had, in the meanwhile, quietly shut the door. He wore a mask, and now stood motionless while the others completed their work.
"All safe, citoyen,"
said one of the men, as he took a final survey of the bounds which secured the 2 young men.
"Good," replied the man at the door. "Now search their pockets and give me all the papers you find."
This was promptly and quietly done. The masked man, having taken possession of all the papers, listened for a moment or two if there were any sound within the Fisherman's Rest. Evidently satisfied that this dastardly outrage had remained unheard, he once more opened the door and pointed peremptorily down the passage. The 4 men lifted Sir Andrew and Lord Antony from the ground, and as quietly, as noiselessly as they had come, they bore the 2 pinioned young gallants out of the inn and along the Dover Road into the gloom beyond. In the coffee room, the masked leader of this daring attempt was quickly glancing through the stolen papers.
"Not a bad day's work on the whole,"
he muttered as he quietly took off his mask, and his pale, fox-like eyes glittered in the red glow of the fire.
"Not a bad day's work."
He opened 1 or 2 more letters from Sir Andrew Ffoulkes's pocketbook, noted the tiny scrap of paper which the 2 young men had only just had time to read, but 1 letter specially, signed Armand Saint-Just, seemed to give him strange satisfaction.
"Armand Saint-Just a traitor after all," he murmured. "Now, fair Marguerite Blakeney," he added viciously between his clenched teeth, "I think that you will help me to find the Scarlet Pimpernel."
Chapter 10. In the Opera Box. It was one of the gala nights at Covent Garden Theatre, the first of the autumn season in this memorable year of grace 1792. The house was packed, both in the smart orchestra boxes and the pit, as well as in the more plebeian balconies and galleries above. Gluck's Orpheus made a strong appeal to the more intellectual portions of the house, whilst the fashionable women, the gaily dressed and brilliant throng, spoke to the eye of those who cared but little for this latest importation from Germany. Selina Storace had been duly applauded after her grand aria by her numerous admirers. Benjamin Incledon, the acknowledged favourite of the ladies, had received special gracious recognition from the royal box, and now the curtain came down after the glorious finale to the 2nd act, and the audience, which had hung spellbound on the magic strains of the great maestro, seemed collectively to breathe a long sigh of satisfaction, previous to letting loose its hundreds of waggish and frivolous tongues. In the smart orchestra boxes, many well-known faces were to be seen. Mr. Pitt, overweighted with cares of state, was finding brief relaxation in tonight's musical treat. The Prince of Wales, jovial, rotund, somewhat coarse and commonplace in appearance, moved about from box to box, spending brief quarters of an hour with those of his more intimate friends. In Lord Grenville's box, too, a curious, interesting personality attracted everyone's attention. A thin, small figure with shrewd, sarcastic face and deep-set eyes, attentive to the music, keenly critical of the audience, dressed in immaculate black, with dark hair free from any powder. Lord Grenville, Foreign Secretary of State, paid him marked, though frigid, deference. Here and there, dotted about among distinctly English types of beauty, 1 or 2 foreign faces stood out in marked contrast. The haughty aristocratic cast of countenance of the many French royalist émigrés who, persecuted by the relentless revolutionary faction of their country, had found a peaceful refuge in England. On these faces sorrow and care were deeply writ. The women especially paid but little heed either to the music or to the brilliant audience. No doubt their thoughts were far away with husband, brother, son, maybe, still in peril or lately succumbed to a cruel fate. Among these, the Comtesse de Tournay de Basserive, but lately arrived from France, was a most conspicuous figure. Dressed in deep, heavy black silk, with only a white lace kerchief to relieve the aspect of mourning about her person, she sat beside Lady Portarles, who was vainly trying, by witty sallies and somewhat broad jokes, to bring a smile to the Comtesse's sad mouth.
Behind her sat little Suzanne and the Vicomte, both silent and somewhat shy among so many strangers. Suzanne's eyes seemed wistful. When she first entered the crowded house, she had looked eagerly all round, scanned every face, scrutinized every box. Evidently the one face she wished to see was not there, for she settled herself down quietly behind her mother, listened apathetically to the music, and took no further interest in the audience itself.
"Ah, Lord Grenville,"
said Lady Portarles, as, following a discreet knock, the clever, interesting head of the Secretary of State appeared in the doorway of the box.
"You could not arrive more apropos. Here is Madame la Comtesse de Tournay, positively dying to hear the latest news from France."
The distinguished diplomatist had come forward and was shaking hands with the ladies.
"Alas," he said sadly, "it is of the very worst. The massacres continue, Paris literally reeks with blood, and the guillotine claims 100 victims a day."
Pale and tearful, the Comtesse was leaning back in her chair, listening horror-struck to this brief and graphic account of what went on in her own misguided country.
"Ah, monsieur," she said in broken English, "it is dreadful to hear all that, and my poor husband still in that awful country. It is terrible for me to be sitting here in the theatre, all safe and in peace, whilst he is in such peril."
"Oh, lad, madame," said honest, bluff Lady Portarles, "your sitting in a convent won't make your husband safe. And you have your children to consider. They are too young to be dosed with anxiety and premature mourning."
The Comtesse smiled through her tears at the vehemence of her friend. Lady Portarles, whose voice and manner would not have misfitted a jockey, had a heart of gold, and hid the most genuine sympathy and most gentle kindliness beneath the somewhat coarse manners affected by some ladies at that time.
"Besides which, madame," added Lord Grenville, "did you not tell me yesterday that the League of the Scarlet Pimpernel had pledged their honour to bring Monsieur le Comte safely across the Channel?"
"Ah, yes," replied the Comtesse, "and that is my only hope. I saw Lord Hastings yesterday. He reassured me again."
"Then I am sure you need have no fear. What the League have sworn, that they surely will accomplish."
"Ah," added the old diplomatist with a sigh, "if I were but a few years younger."
"La, man,"
interrupted honest Lady Portarles,
"you are still young enough to turn your back on that French scarecrow that sits enthroned in your box tonight."
"I wish I could. But your ladyship must remember that in serving our country we must put prejudices aside. Monsieur Chauvelin is the accredited agent of his government."
"Odds fish, man," she retorted. "You don't call those bloodthirsty ruffians over there a government, do you?"
"It has not been thought advisable as yet," said the minister guardedly, "for England to break off diplomatic relations with France, and we cannot therefore refuse to receive with courtesy the agent she wishes to send to us."
"Diplomatic relations be damned, my lord. That sly little fox over there is nothing but a spy, I'll warrant, and you'll find, and I'm much mistaken, that he'll concern himself little with diplomacy beyond trying to do mischief to royalist refugees, to our heroic Scarlet Pimpernel, and to the members of that brave little league."
"I am sure," said the Comtesse, pursing up her thin lips, "that if this Chauvelin wishes to do us mischief, he will find a faithful ally in Lady Blakeney."
"Bless the woman!" ejaculated Lady Portarles. "Did ever anyone see such perversity? My Lord Grenville, you have the gift of the gab. Will you please explain to Madame la Comtesse that she is acting like a fool? In your position here in England, madame," she added, turning a wrathful and resolute face towards the Comtesse, "you cannot afford to put on the hoity-toity airs you French aristocrats are so fond of. Lady Blakeney may or may not be in sympathy with those ruffians in France. She may or may not have had anything to do with the arrest and condemnation of Saint-Cyr, or whatever the man's name is. But she is the leader of fashion in this country. Sir Percy Blakeney has more money than any half-dozen other men put together. He is hand and glove with royalty, and your trying to snub Lady Blakeney will not harm her, but will make you look a fool. Isn't that so, my lord?"
But what Lord Grenville thought of this matter, or to what reflections this homely tirade of Lady Portarles led the Comtesse de Tournay, remained unspoken, for the curtain had just risen on the third act of Orpheus, and admonishments to silence came from every part of the house. Lord Grenville took a hasty farewell of the ladies and slipped back into his box, where Monsieur Chauvelin had sat all through this entr'acte, with his eternal snuff-box in his hand, and with his keen, pale eyes intently fixed upon a box opposite to him, where, with much frou-frou of silken skirts, much laughter and general stir of curiosity amongst the audience, Marguerite Blakeney had just entered, accompanied by her husband, and looking divinely pretty beneath the wealth of her golden reddish curls, slightly besprinkled with powder, and tied back at the nape of her graceful neck with a gigantic black bow. Always dressed in the very latest vagary of fashion, Marguerite alone among the ladies that night had discarded the crossover fichu and broad-lapelled overdress, which had been in fashion for the last 2 or 3 years. She wore the short-waisted classical-shaped gown, which so soon was to become the approved mode in every country in Europe. It suited her graceful, regal figure to perfection, composed as it was of shimmering stuff which seemed a mass of rich gold embroidery. As she entered, she leant for a moment out of the box, taking stock of all those present whom she knew. Many bowed to her as she did so, and from the royal box there came also a quick and gracious salute. Chauvelin watched her intently all through the commencement of the third act, as she sat enthralled with the music, her exquisite little hand toying with a small jewelled fan, her regal head, her throat, arms and neck covered with magnificent diamonds and rare gems, the gift of the adoring husband who sprawled leisurely by her side. Marguerite was passionately fond of music. Orpheus charmed her tonight. The very joy of living was writ plainly upon the sweet young face. It sparkled out of the merry blue eyes and lit up the smile that lurked around the lips. She was, after all, but 25, in the heyday of youth, the darling of a brilliant throng, adored, feted, petted, cherished. 2 days ago the Daydream had returned from Calais, bringing her news that her idolized brother had safely landed, that he thought of her, and would be prudent for her sake. What wonder for the moment, and listening to Gluck's impassioned strains, that she forgot her disillusionments, forgot her vanished love-dreams, forgot even the lazy, good-humoured nonentity who had made up for his lack of spiritual attainments by lavishing worldly advantages upon her. He had stayed beside her in the box just as long as convention demanded, making way for His Royal Highness and for the host of admirers who, in a continued procession, came to pay homage to the Queen of Fashion. Sir Percy had strolled away to talk to more congenial friends, probably. Marguerite did not even wonder whither he had gone, she cared so little. She had had a little court round her, composed of the jeunesse dorée of London, and had just dismissed them all, wishing to be alone with Gluck for a brief while. A discreet knock at the door roused her from her enjoyment. "Come in," she said with some impatience, without turning to look at the intruder. Chauvelin, waiting for his opportunity, noted that she was alone, and now, without pausing for that impatient "come in," he quietly slipped into the box, and the next moment was standing behind Marguerite's chair. "A word with you, citoyenne," he said quietly. Marguerite turned quickly, in alarm, which was not altogether feigned. "Oh, lad, man, you frightened me," she said with a forced little laugh. "Your presence is entirely inopportune. I want to listen to Gluck, and have no mind for talking." "But this is my only opportunity," he said, as quietly and without waiting for permission he drew a chair close behind her, so close that he could whisper in her ear without disturbing the audience and without being seen in the dark background of the box. "This is my only opportunity," he repeated, as she vouchsafed him no reply. "Lady Blakeney is always so surrounded, so feted by her court, that a mere old friend has but little chance." "Faith, man," she said impatiently, "you must seek for another opportunity, then. I am going to Lord Grenville's ball tonight after the opera, so are you, probably. I'll give you 5 minutes, then."
"3 minutes in the privacy of this box are quite sufficient for me," he rejoined placidly, "and I think that you would be wise to listen to me, citoyenne Saint-Just."
Marguerite instinctively shivered. Chauvelin had not raised his voice above a whisper. He was now quietly taking a pinch of snuff, yet there was something in his attitude, something in those pale, foxy eyes, which seemed to freeze the blood in her veins, as would the sight of some deadly, hitherto unguessed peril. "Is that a threat, citoyen?" she asked at last.
"Nay, fair lady," he said gallantly, "only an arrow shot into the air."
He paused a moment, like a cat which sees a mouse running heedlessly by, ready to spring, yet waiting with that feline sense of enjoyment of mischief about to be done. Then he said quietly, "Your brother, Saint-Just, is in peril." Not a muscle moved in the beautiful face before him. He could only see it in profile, for Marguerite seemed to be watching the stage intently, but Chauvelin was a keen observer. He noticed the sudden rigidity of the eyes, the hardening of the mouth, the sharp, almost paralyzed tension of the beautiful, graceful figure.
"Lad, then," she said with affected merriment, "since it is one of your imaginary plots, you'd best go back to your own seat and leave me to enjoy the music."
And with her hand she began to beat time nervously against the cushion of the box. Selina Storace was singing the Che Faro to an audience that hung spellbound upon the prima donna's lips. Chauvelin did not move from his seat. He quietly watched that tiny, nervous hand, the only indication that his shaft had indeed struck home.
"Well?" she said suddenly and irrelevantly, and with the same feigned unconcern.
"Well, citoyen?"
he rejoined placidly.
"About my brother?"
"I have news of him for you which I think will interest you, but first let me explain, may I?"
The question was unnecessary. He felt, though Marguerite still held her head steadily averted from him, that her every nerve was strained to hear what he had to say.
"The other day, citoyen," he said, "I asked for your help. France needed it, and I thought I could rely on you. But you gave me your answer. Since then, the exigencies of my own affairs and your own social duties have kept us apart,
although many things have happened."
"To the point, I pray you, citoyen," she said lightly. "The music is entrancing, and the audience will get impatient of your talk."
"One moment, citoyen. The day on which I had the honour of meeting you at Dover, and less than an hour after I had your final answer, I obtained possession of some papers which revealed another of those subtle schemes for the escape of a batch of French aristocrats, that traitor de Tournay, amongst others, all organized by that arch-meddler, the Scarlet Pimpernel. Some of the threads, too, of this mysterious organization have fallen into my hands, but not all, and I want you, nay, you must help me to gather them together."
Marguerite seemed to have listened to him with marked impatience. She now shrugged her shoulders and said gaily,
"Bah, man, have I not told you already that I care not about your schemes or about the Scarlet Pimpernel? And had you not spoken about my brother?"
"A little patience, I entreat, citoyen," he continued imperturbably. "Two gentlemen, Lord Anthony Dewhurst and Sir Andrew Ffoulkes, were at the Fisherman's Rest at Dover the same night."
"I know. I saw them there."
"They were already known to my spies as members of that accursed league. It was Sir Andrew Ffoulkes who escorted the Comtesse de Tournay and her children across the Channel.
When the two young men were alone, my spies forced their way into the coffee-room of the inn, gagged and pinioned the two gallants, seized their papers, and brought them to me."
In a moment she had guessed the danger. Papers? Had Armand been imprudent? The very thought struck her with nameless terror. Still, she would not let this man see that she feared. She laughed gaily and lightly.
"Faith, and your impudence passes belief," she said merrily. "Robbery and violence in England, in a crowded inn. Your men might have been caught in the act."
"What if they had? They are children of France, and have been trained by your humble servant. Had they been caught, they would have gone to jail, or even to the gallows, without a word of protest or indiscretion. At any rate, it was well worth the risk. A crowded inn is safer for these little operations than you think, and my men have experience."
"Well, and those papers?" she asked carelessly.
"Unfortunately, though they have given me cognizance of certain names, certain movements, enough, I think, to thwart their projected coup for the moment, it would only be for the moment, and still leaves me in ignorance of the identity of the Scarlet Pimpernel."
"Hola, my friend," she said, with the same assumed flippancy of manner. "Then you are where you were before, aren't you? And you can let me enjoy the last strophe of the aria. Faith," she added, ostentatiously smothering an imaginary yawn, "had you not spoken about my brother—"
"I am coming to him now, citoyen. Among the papers there was a letter to Sir Andrew Ffoulkes, written by your brother Saint-Just."
"Well, and—"
"That letter shows him to be not only in sympathy with the enemies of France, but actually a helper, if not a member, of the League of the Scarlet Pimpernel."
The blow had been struck at last. All along Marguerite had been expecting it. She would not show fear. She was determined to seem unconcerned, flippant even. She wished, when the shock came, to be prepared for it, to have all her wits about her, those wits which had been nicknamed the keenest in Europe. Even now she did not flinch. She knew that Chauvelin had spoken the truth. The man was too earnest, too blindly devoted to the misguided cause he had at heart, too proud of his countrymen, of those makers of revolutions to stoop to low, purposeless falsehoods. That letter of Armand's, foolish, imprudent Armand, was in Chauvelin's hands. Marguerite knew that, as if she had seen the letter with her own eyes, and Chauvelin would hold that letter for purposes of his own until it suited him to destroy it or to make use of it against Armand. All that she knew, and yet she continued to laugh more gaily, more loudly than she had done before. "La, man," she said, speaking over her shoulder and looking him full and squarely in the face. "Did I not say it was some imaginary plot? Armand in league with that enigmatic Scarlet Pimpernel. Armand busy helping those French aristocrats whom he despises. Faith, the tale does infinite credit to your imagination." "Let me make my point clear, citoyenne," said Chauvelin with the same unruffled calm. "I must assure you that Saint-Just is compromised beyond the slightest hope of pardon." Inside the orchestra box, all was silent for a moment or two. Marguerite sat, straight upright, rigid and inert, trying to think, trying to face the situation, to realize what had best be done. In the house, Dorace had finished the aria, and was even now bowing in her classic garb, but in approved 18th-century fashion, to the enthusiastic audience, who cheered her to the echo. "Chauvelin," said Marguerite Blakeney at last, quietly and without that touch of bravado which had characterized her attitude all along. "Chauvelin, my friend, shall we try to understand one another? It seems that my wits have become rusty by contact with this damp climate. Now tell me, you are very anxious to discover the identity of the Scarlet Pimpernel, isn't that so?" "France's most bitter enemy, citoyenne, all the more dangerous as he works in the dark." "All the more noble, you mean? Well, and you would now force me to do some spying work for you in exchange for my brother Armand's safety, is that it?" "Fie, two very ugly words, fair lady," protested Chauvelin urbanely. "There can be no question of force, and the service which I would ask of you in the name of France could never be called by the shocking name of spying." "At any rate, that is what it is called over here," she said dryly. "That is your intention, is it not?" "My intention is that you yourself win a free pardon for Armand Saint-Just by doing me a small service."
"What is it?"
"Only watch for me tonight, citoyen Saint-Just," he said eagerly. "Listen, among the papers which were found about the person of Sir Andrew Ffoulkes, there was the tiny note. See," he added, taking a tiny scrap of paper from his pocketbook and handing it to her. It was the same scrap of paper which, 4 days ago, the two young men had been in the act of reading, at the very moment when they were attacked by Chauvelin's minions. Marguerite took it mechanically and stooped to read it. There were only two lines, written in a distorted, evidently disguised handwriting. She read them half aloud. "Remember, we must not meet more often than is strictly necessary. You have all instructions for the second. If you wish to speak to me again, I shall be at G's ball." "What does it mean?" she asked. "Look again, citoyenne, and you will understand."
"There is a device here in the corner, a small red flower."
"Yes."
"The Scarlet Pimpernel," she said eagerly. "And G's ball means Grenville's ball. He will be at my Lord Grenville's ball tonight."
"That is how I interpret the note, citoyenne," concluded Chauvelin blandly. "Lord Anthony Dewhurst and Sir Andrew Ffoulkes, after they were pinioned and searched by my spies, were carried by my orders to a lonely house on the Dover Road, which I had rented for the purpose. There they remained close prisoners until this morning. But having found this tiny scrap of paper, my intention was that they should be in London in time to attend my Lord Grenville's ball. You see, do you not, that they must have a great deal to say to their chief, and thus they will have an opportunity of speaking to him tonight, just as he directed them to do. Therefore, this morning, those two young gallants found every bar and bolt open in that lonely house on the Dover Road, their trailers disappeared, and two good horses standing ready saddled and tethered in the yard. I have not seen them yet, but I think we may safely conclude that they did not draw rein until they reached London. Now you see how simple it all is, citoyenne."
"It does seem simple, doesn't it?" she said, with a final bitter attempt at flippancy. "When you want to kill a chicken, you take hold of it, then you wring its neck. It's only the chicken who does not find it quite so simple. Now you hold a knife at my throat and a hostage for my obedience. You find it simple. I don't."
"Nay, citoyenne, I offer you a chance of saving the brother you love from the consequences of his own folly."
Marguerite's face softened. Her eyes at last grew moist, as she murmured half to herself, "The only being in the world who has loved me truly and constantly." "But what do you want me to do, Chauvelin?" she said, with a world of despair in her tear-choked voice. "In my present position, it is well-nigh impossible." "Nay, citoyenne," he said dryly and relentlessly, not heeding that despairing, childlike appeal which might have melted a heart of stone. "As Lady Blakeney, no one suspects you, and with your help tonight I may, who knows, succeed in finally establishing the identity of the Scarlet Pimpernel. You are going to the ball, anon. Watch for me there, citoyenne, watch and listen. You can tell me if you hear a chance word or whisper. You can note everyone to whom Sir Andrew Ffoulkes or Lord Anthony Dewhurst will speak. You are absolutely beyond suspicion now. The Scarlet Pimpernel will be at Lord Grenville's ball tonight. Find out who he is, and I will pledge the word of France that your brother shall be safe." Chauvelin was putting the knife to her throat. Marguerite felt herself entangled in one of those webs from which she could hope for no escape. A precious hostage was being held for her obedience, for she knew that this man would never make an empty threat. No doubt Armand was already signalled to the Committee of Public Safety as one of the suspect. He would not be allowed to leave France again, and would be ruthlessly struck if she refused to obey Chauvelin. For a moment, womanlike, she still hoped to temporize. She held out her hand to this man, whom she now feared and hated. "If I promise to help you in this matter, Chauvelin," she said pleasantly, "will you give me that letter of Saint-Just's?" "If you render me useful assistance tonight, citoyenne," he replied with a sarcastic smile, "I will give you that letter tomorrow."
"You do not trust me?"
"I trust you absolutely, dear lady, but Saint-Just's life is forfeit to his country. It rests with you to redeem it."
"I may be powerless to help you," she pleaded, "were I ever so willing."
"That would be terrible indeed," he said quietly, "for you and for Saint-Just." Marguerite shuddered. She felt that from this man she could expect no mercy. All-powerful, he held the beloved life in the hollow of his hand. She knew him too well not to know that, if he failed in gaining his own ends, he would be pitiless. She felt cold in spite of the oppressive air at the opera house. The heart-appealing strains of the music seemed to reach her as from a distant land. She drew her costly lace scarf up around her shoulders and sat silently watching the brilliant scene as if in a dream. For a moment her thoughts wandered away from the loved one who was in danger to that other man who also had a claim on her confidence and her affection. She felt lonely, frightened for Armand's sake. She longed to seek comfort and advice from someone who would know how to help and console. Sir Percy Blakeney had loved her once. He was her husband. Why should she stand alone through this terrible ordeal? He had very little brains, it is true, but he had plenty of muscle. Surely, if she provided the thought and he the manly energy and pluck, together they could outwit the astute diplomatist and save the hostage from his vengeful hands, without imperilling the life of the noble leader of that gallant little band of heroes. Sir Percy knew Saint-Just well. He seemed attached to him. She was sure that he could help. Chauvelin was taking no further heed of her. He had said his cruel either-or and left her to decide. He, in his turn now, appeared to be absorbed in the soul-stirring melodies of Orpheus, and was beating time to the music with his sharp, ferret-like head. A discreet rap at the door roused Marguerite from her thoughts. It was Sir Percy Blakeney, tall, sleepy, good-humoured, and wearing that half-shy, half-inane smile which just now seemed to irritate her every nerve.
Your chair is outside, my dear," he said with his most exasperating drawl. "I suppose you will want to go to that demmed ball. Oh, excuse me, Monsieur Chauvelin, I had not observed you."
He extended two slender white fingers towards Chauvelin, who had risen when Sir Percy entered the box.
"Are you coming, my dear?"
"Hush! Shh! Shh!" came in angry remonstrance from different parts of the house.
"Demmed impudence,"
commented Sir Percy with a good-natured smile. Marguerite sighed impatiently. Her last hope seemed suddenly to have vanished away. She wrapped her cloak round her, and without looking at her husband, "I am ready to go," she said, taking his arm. At the door of the box she turned and looked straight at Chauvelin, who, with his chapeau bras under his arm and a curious smile round his thin lips, was preparing to follow the strangely ill-assorted couple.
"It is only au revoir, Chauvelin," she said pleasantly. "We shall meet at my Lord Grenville's ball anon."
And in her eyes the astute Frenchman read, no doubt, something which caused him profound satisfaction. For, with a sarcastic smile, he took a delicate pinch of snuff, then, having dusted his dainty lace jabot, he rubbed his thin, bony hands contentedly together. Chapter 11. Lord Grenville's Ball. The historic ball given by the then Secretary of State for Foreign Affairs, Lord Grenville, was the most brilliant function of the year. Though the autumn season had only just begun, everybody who was anybody had contrived to be in London in time to be present there, and to shine at this ball to the best of his or her respective ability. His Royal Highness the Prince of Wales had promised to be present. He was coming on presently from the opera. Lord Grenville himself had listened to the two first acts of Orpheus before preparing to receive his guests. At 10 o'clock, an unusually late hour in those days, the grand rooms of the Foreign Office, exquisitely decorated with exotic palms and flowers, were filled to overflowing. One room had been set apart for dancing, and the dainty strains of the minuet made a soft accompaniment to the gay chatter, the merry laughter of the numerous and brilliant company. In a smaller chamber, facing the top of the fine stairway, the distinguished host stood ready to receive his guests. Distinguished men, beautiful women, notabilities from every European country had already filed past him, had exchanged the elaborate bows and curtsies with him, which the extravagant fashion of the time demanded, and then, laughing and talking, had dispersed in the ball, reception, and card rooms beyond. Not far from Lord Grenville's elbow, leaning against one of the console tables, Chauvelin, in his irreproachable black costume, was taking a quiet survey of the brilliant throng. He noted that Sir Percy and Lady Blakeney had not yet arrived, and his keen, pale eyes glanced quickly towards the door every time a newcomer appeared. He stood somewhat isolated. The envoy of the revolutionary government of France was not likely to be very popular in England at a time when the news of the awful September massacres and of the reign of terror and anarchy had just begun to filtrate across the Channel. In his official capacity, he had been received courteously by his English colleagues. Mr. Pitt had shaken him by the hand. Lord Grenville had entertained him more than once. But the more intimate circles of London society ignored him altogether. The women openly turned their backs upon him. The men who held no official position refused to shake his hand. But Chauvelin was not the man to trouble himself about these social amenities, which he called mere incidents in his diplomatic career. He was blindly enthusiastic for the revolutionary cause. He despised all social inequalities, and he had a burning love for his own country. These three sentiments made him supremely indifferent to the snubs he received in this fog-ridden, loyalist, old-fashioned England. But above all, Chauvelin had a purpose at heart. He firmly believed that the French aristocrat was the most bitter enemy of France. He would have wished to see every one of them annihilated. He was one of those who, during this awful reign of terror, had been the first to utter the historic and ferocious desire that aristocrats might have but one head between them, so that it might be cut off with a single stroke of the guillotine. And thus he looked upon every French aristocrat who had succeeded in escaping from France as so much prey of which the guillotine had been unwarrantably cheated. There is no doubt that those royalist émigrés, once they had managed to cross the frontier, did their very best to stir up foreign indignation against France. Plots without end were hatched in England, in Belgium, in Holland, to try and induce some great power to send troops into revolutionary Paris, to free King Louis, and to summarily hang the bloodthirsty leaders of that monster republic. Small wonder, therefore, that the romantic and mysterious personality of the Scarlet Pimpernel was a source of bitter hatred to Chauvelin. He and the few young jackanapes under his command, well furnished with money, armed with boundless daring and acute cunning, had succeeded in rescuing hundreds of aristocrats from France. 9/10 of the émigrés who were fêted at the English court owed their safety to that man and to his league.
Chauvelin had sworn to his colleagues in Paris that he would discover the identity of that meddlesome Englishman, entice him over to France, and then... Chauvelin drew a deep breath of satisfaction at the very thought of seeing that enigmatic head falling under the knife of the guillotine as easily as that of any other man. Suddenly there was a great stir on the handsome staircase. All conversation stopped for a moment as the majordomo's voice outside announced, "His Royal Highness, the Prince of Wales and Sweet, Sir Percy Blakeney, Lady Blakeney." Lord Grenville went quickly to the door to receive his exalted guest. The Prince of Wales, dressed in a magnificent court suit of salmon-coloured velvet richly embroidered with gold, entered with Marguerite Blakeney on his arm, and on his left Sir Percy, in gorgeous, shimmering cream satin, cut in the extravagant, incroyable style, his fair hair free from powder, priceless lace at his neck and wrists, and the flat chapeau bras under his arm. After the few conventional words of deferential greeting, Lord Grenville said to his royal guest, "Will Your Highness permit me to introduce Monsieur Chauvelin, the accredited agent of the French government?" Chauvelin, immediately the prince entered, had stepped forward, expecting this introduction. He bowed very low, whilst the prince returned his salute with a curt nod of the head. "Monsieur," said his Royal Highness coldly, "we will try to forget the government that sent you, and look upon you merely as our guest, a private gentleman from France. As such, you are welcome, monsieur." "Monseigneur," rejoined Chauvelin, bowing once again. "Madame," he added, bowing ceremoniously before Marguerite. "Ah, my little Chauvelin," she said with unconcerned gaiety, and extending her tiny hand to him. "Monsieur and I are old friends, Your Royal Highness." "Ah, then," said the prince, this time very graciously, "you are doubly welcome, monsieur." "There is someone else I would crave permission to present to Your Royal Highness," here interposed Lord Grenville. "Ah, who is it?" asked the prince. "Madame la Comtesse de Tournay de Basserive and her family, who have but recently come from France." "By all means. They are among the lucky ones, then." Lord Grenville turned in search of the Comtesse, who sat at the further end of the room. "Lord love me," whispered his Royal Highness to Marguerite, as soon as he had caught sight of the rigid figure of the old lady. "Lord love me, she looks very virtuous and very melancholy."
"Faith, Your Royal Highness," she rejoined with a smile, "virtue is like precious odours, most fragrant when it is crushed."
"Virtue, alas," sighed the prince, "is mostly unbecoming to your charming sex, madame." "Madame la Comtesse de Tournay de Basserive," said Lord Grenville, introducing the lady. "This is a pleasure, madame. My royal father, as you know, is ever glad to welcome those of your compatriots whom France has driven from her shores."
"Your Royal Highness is ever gracious," replied the Comtesse with becoming dignity. Then, indicating her daughter, who stood timidly by her side, "My daughter Suzanne, Monseigneur," she said.
"Ah, charming, charming," said the prince. "And now allow me, Comtesse, to introduce to you Lady Blakeney, who honours us with her friendship. You and she will have much to say to one another, I vow. Every compatriot of Lady Blakeney's is doubly welcome for her sake. Her friends are our friends, her enemies the enemies of England." Marguerite's blue eyes had twinkled with merriment at this gracious speech from her exalted friend. The Comtesse de Tournay, who lately had so flagrantly insulted her, was here receiving a public lesson, at which Marguerite could not help but rejoice. But the Comtesse, for whom respect of royalty amounted almost to a religion, was too well schooled in courtly etiquette to show the slightest sign of embarrassment, as the two ladies curtsied ceremoniously to one another.
"His Royal Highness is ever gracious, madame," said Marguerite, demurely, and with a wealth of mischief in her twinkling blue eyes. "But here there is no need for his kind mediation. Your amiable reception of me at our last meeting still dwells pleasantly in my memory."
"We poor exiles, madame," rejoined the Comtesse frigidly, "show our gratitude to England by devotion to the wishes of Monseigneur."
"Madame," said Marguerite, with another ceremonious curtsy.
"Madame," responded the Comtesse with equal dignity. The prince, in the meanwhile, was saying a few gracious words to the young Vicomte.
"I am happy to know you, Monsieur le Vicomte," he said. "I knew your father well when he was ambassador in London."
"Ah, Monseigneur," replied the Vicomte, "I was a little boy then, and now I owe the honour of this meeting to our protector, the Scarlet Pimpernel."
"Hush," said the Prince earnestly and quickly, as he indicated Chauvelin, who had stood a little on one side throughout the whole of this little scene, watching Marguerite and the Comtesse with an amused, sarcastic little smile around his thin lips. "Nay, Monseigneur," he said now, as if in direct response to the Prince's challenge, "pray do not check this gentleman's display of gratitude. The name of that interesting red flower is well known to me, and to France." The Prince looked at him keenly for a moment or two. "Faith, then, monsieur," he said, "perhaps you know more about our national hero than we do ourselves. Perchance you know who he is. See," he added, turning to the groups round the room, "the ladies hang upon your lips. You would render yourself popular among the fair sex if you were to gratify their curiosity." "Ah, monseigneur," said Chauvelin significantly, "rumour has it in France that your highness could, and you would, give the truest account of that enigmatical wayside flower." He looked quickly and keenly at Marguerite as he spoke, but she betrayed no emotion, and her eyes met his quite fearlessly. "Nay, man," replied the Prince, "my lips are sealed, and the members of the League jealously guard the secret of their chief, so his fair adorers have to be content with worshipping a shadow. Here in England, monsieur," he added with wonderful charm and dignity, "we but name the Scarlet Pimpernel, and every fair cheek is suffused with a blush of enthusiasm. None have seen him save his faithful lieutenants. We know not if he be tall or short, fair or dark, handsome or ill-formed, but we know that he is the bravest gentleman in all the world, and we all feel a little proud, monsieur, when we remember that he is an Englishman."
"Ah, Monsieur Chauvelin," added Marguerite, looking almost with defiance across at the placid, sphinx-like face of the Frenchman, "His Royal Highness should add that we ladies think of him as of a hero of old. We worship him. We wear his badge. We tremble for him when he is in danger, and exult with him in the hour of his victory."
Chauvelin did no more than bow placidly both to the Prince and to Marguerite. He felt that both speeches were intended, each in their way, to convey contempt or defiance. The pleasure-loving, idle prince he despised. The beautiful woman who, in her golden hair, wore a spray of small red flowers composed of rubies and diamonds. Her he held in the hollow of his hand. He could afford to remain silent and to await events. A long, jovial, inane laugh broke the sudden silence which had fallen over everyone. "And we poor husbands," came in slow, affected accents from gorgeous Sir Percy, "we have to stand by while they worship a damned shadow." Everyone laughed, the Prince more loudly than anyone. The tension of subdued excitement was relieved, and the next moment everyone was laughing and chatting merrily as the gay crowd broke up and dispersed in the adjoining rooms. Chapter 12. The Scrap of Paper. Marguerite suffered intensely. Though she laughed and chatted, though she was more admired, more surrounded, more fêted than any woman there, she felt like one condemned to death, living her last day upon this earth. Her nerves were in a state of painful tension, which had increased a hundredfold during that brief hour which she had spent in her husband's company, between the opera and the ball. The short ray of hope, that she might find in this good-natured, lazy individual a valuable friend and adviser, had vanished as quickly as it had come, the moment she found herself alone with him. The same feeling of good-humoured contempt which one feels for an animal or a faithful servant made her turn away with a smile from the man who should have been her moral support in this heart-rending crisis through which she was passing, who should have been her cool-headed adviser when feminine sympathy and sentiment tossed her hither and thither between her love for her brother, who was far away and in mortal peril, and horror of the awful service which Chauvelin had exacted from her in exchange for Armand's safety. There he stood, the moral support, the cool-headed adviser, surrounded by a crowd of brainless, empty-headed young fops, who were even now repeating from mouth to mouth, and with every sign of the keenest enjoyment, a doggerel couplet which he had just given forth. Everywhere the absurd, silly words met her.
People seem to have little else to speak about. Even the prince had asked her, with a laugh, whether she appreciated her husband's latest poetic efforts.
"All done in the tying of a cravat," Sir Percy had declared to his clique of admirers. "We seek him here, we seek him there. Those Frenchies seek him everywhere. Is he in heaven? Is he in hell? That demmed elusive Pimpernel!"
Sir Percy's bon mot had gone the round of the brilliant reception rooms. The prince was enchanted. He vowed that life without Blakeney would be but a dreary desert. Then, taking him by the arm, had led him to the card room and engaged him in a long game of hazard.
Sir Percy, whose chief interest in most social gatherings seemed to centre round the card table, usually allowed his wife to flirt, dance, to amuse or bore herself as much as she liked. And tonight, having delivered himself of his bon mot, he had left Marguerite surrounded by a crowd of admirers of all ages, all anxious and willing to help her to forget that somewhere in the spacious reception rooms there was a long, lazy being who had been fool enough to suppose that the cleverest woman in Europe would settle down to the prosaic bonds of English matrimony. Her still overwrought nerves, her excitement and agitation, lent beautiful Marguerite Blakeney much additional charm. Escorted by a veritable bevy of men of all ages and of most nationalities, she called forth many exclamations of admiration from everyone as she passed. She would not allow herself any more time to think. Her early, somewhat bohemian training had made her something of a fatalist. She felt that events would shape themselves, that the directing of them was not in her hands. From Chauvelin she knew that she could expect no mercy. He had set a price upon Armand's head, and left it to her to pay or not, as she chose. Later on in the evening she caught sight of Sir Andrew Ffoulkes and Lord Antony Dewhurst, who seemingly had just arrived. She noticed at once that Sir Andrew immediately made for little Suzanne de Tournay, and that the two young people soon managed to isolate themselves in one of the deep embrasures of the mullioned windows, there to carry on a long conversation which seemed very earnest and very pleasant on both sides. Both the young men looked a little haggard and anxious, but otherwise they were irreproachably dressed, and there was not the slightest sign about their courtly demeanour of the terrible catastrophe which they must have felt hovering round them and round their chief. That the League of the Scarlet Pimpernel had no intention of abandoning its cause, she had gathered through little Suzanne herself, who spoke openly of the assurance she and her mother had had that the Comte de Tournay would be rescued from France by the League within the next few days. Vaguely she began to wonder, as she looked at the brilliant and fashionable crowd in the gaily lighted ballroom, which of these worldly men round her was the mysterious Scarlet Pimpernel, who held the threads of such daring plots and the fate of valuable lives in his hands. A burning curiosity seized her to know him. Although for months she had heard of him and had accepted his anonymity as everyone else in society had done, but now she longed to know, quite impersonally, quite apart from Armand, and oh, quite apart from Chauvelin, only for her own sake, for the sake of the enthusiastic admiration she had always bestowed on his bravery and cunning. He was at the ball, of course, somewhere, since Sir Andrew Ffoulkes and Lord Antony Dewhurst were here, evidently expecting to meet their chief, and perhaps to get a fresh mot d'ordre from him. Marguerite looked round at everyone, at the aristocratic, high-typed Norman faces, the squarely built, fair-haired Saxon, the more gentle, humorous cast of the Celt, wondering which of these betrayed the power, the energy, the cunning which had imposed its will and its leadership upon a number of high-born English gentlemen, among whom, rumour asserted, was His Royal Highness himself. Sir Andrew Ffoulkes? Surely not, with his gentle blue eyes, which were looking so tenderly and longingly after little Suzanne, who was being led away from the pleasant tête-à-tête by her stern mother. Marguerite watched him across the room as he finally turned away with a sigh and seemed to stand aimless and lonely now that Suzanne's dainty little figure had disappeared in the crowd. She watched him as he strolled towards the doorway, which led to a small boudoir beyond, then paused and leaned against the framework of it, looking still anxiously all round him. Marguerite contrived for the moment to evade her present attentive cavalier, and she skirted the fashionable crowd, drawing nearer to the doorway against which Sir Andrew was leaning.
Why she wished to get closer to him she could not have said. Perhaps she was impelled by an all-powerful fatality which so often seems to rule the destinies of men. Suddenly she stopped. Her very heart seemed to stand still. Her eyes, large and excited, flashed for a moment towards that doorway, then as quickly were turned away again. Sir Andrew Ffoulkes was still in the same listless position by the door, but Marguerite had distinctly seen that Lord Hastings, a young buck, a friend of her husband's, and one of the prince's set, had, as he quickly brushed past him, slipped something into his hand. For one moment longer—oh, it was the merest flash—Marguerite paused. The next she had, with admirably played unconcern, resumed her walk across the room, but this time more quickly towards that doorway whence Sir Andrew had now disappeared. All this, from the moment that Marguerite had caught sight of Sir Andrew leaning against the doorway, until she followed him into the little boudoir beyond, had occurred in less than a minute. Fate is usually swift when she deals a blow. Now Lady Blakeney had suddenly ceased to exist. It was Marguerite St-Just who was there only. Marguerite St-Just had passed her childhood, her early youth, in the protecting arms of her brother Armand. She had forgotten everything else—her rank, her dignity, her secret enthusiasms, everything save that Armand stood in peril of his life, and that there, not 20 feet away from her, in the small boudoir which was quite deserted, in the very hands of Sir Andrew Ffoulkes, might be the talisman which would save her brother's life. Barely another 30 seconds had elapsed between the moment when Lord Hastings slipped the mysterious something into Sir Andrew's hand and the one when she, in her turn, reached the deserted boudoir. Sir Andrew was standing with his back to her and close to a table upon which stood a massive silver candelabra. A slip of paper was in his hand, and he was in the very act of perusing its contents. Unperceived, her soft, clinging robe making not the slightest sound upon the heavy carpet, not daring to breathe until she had accomplished her purpose, Marguerite slipped close behind him. At that moment he looked round and saw her. She uttered a groan, passed her hand across her forehead, and murmured faintly,
"The heat in the room was terrible. I felt so faint. Ah!"
She tottered almost as if she would fall, and Sir Andrew, quickly recovering himself and crumpling in his hand the tiny note he had been reading, was only, apparently, just in time to support her.
"You are ill, Lady Blakeney?" he asked, with much concern. "Let me—" "No, no, nothing," she interrupted quickly. "A chair, quick."
She sank into a chair close to the table, and throwing back her head, closed her eyes.
"There," she murmured, still faintly. "The giddiness is passing off. Do not heed me, Sir Andrew. I assure you I already feel better."
At moments like these there is no doubt, and psychologists actually assert it, that there is in us a sense which has absolutely nothing to do with the other five. It is not that we see, it is not that we hear or touch, yet we seem to do all three at once. Marguerite sat there with her eyes apparently closed. Sir Andrew was immediately behind her, and on her right was the table with the five-armed candelabra upon it. Before her mental vision there was absolutely nothing but Armand's face. Armand, whose life was in the most imminent danger, and who seemed to be looking at her from a background upon which were dimly painted the seething crowd of Paris, the bare walls of the Tribunal of Public Safety, with Fouquier Tinville, the public prosecutor, demanding Armand's life in the name of the people of France, and the lurid guillotine with its stained knife waiting for another victim, Armand. For one moment there was dead silence in the little boudoir. Beyond, from the brilliant ballroom, the sweet notes of the gavotte, the frou-frou of rich dresses, the talk and laughter of a large and merry crowd, came as a strange, weird accompaniment to the drama which was being enacted here. Sir Andrew had not uttered another word. Then it was that that extra sense became potent in Marguerite Blakeney. She could not see, for her eyes were closed. She could not hear, for the noise from the ballroom drowned the soft rustle of that momentous scrap of paper. Nevertheless, she knew, as if she had both seen and heard, that Sir Andrew was even now holding the paper to the flame of one of the candles. At the exact moment that it began to catch fire, she opened her eyes, raised her hand, and, with two dainty fingers, had taken the burning scrap of paper from the young man's hand. Then she blew out the flame and held the paper to her nostril with perfect unconcern.
"How thoughtful of you, Sir Andrew,"
she said gaily. "Surely it was your grandmother who taught you that the smell of burnt paper was a sovereign remedy against giddiness." She sighed with satisfaction, holding the paper tightly between her jeweled fingers, that talisman which perhaps would save her brother Armand's life. Sir Andrew was staring at her, too dazed for the moment to realize what had actually happened. He had been taken so completely by surprise that he seemed quite unable to grasp the fact that the slip of paper which she held in her dainty hand was one perhaps on which the life of his comrade might depend. Marguerite burst into a long, merry peal of laughter.
"Why do you stare at me like that?" she said playfully. "I assure you I feel much better. Your remedy has proved most effectual. This room is most delightfully cool," she added with the same perfect composure, "and the sound of the gavotte from the ballroom is fascinating and soothing."
She was prattling on in the most unconcerned and pleasant way, whilst Sir Andrew, in an agony of mind, was racking his brains as to the quickest method he could employ to get that bit of paper out of that beautiful woman's hand. Instinctively, vague and tumultuous thoughts rushed through his mind. He suddenly remembered her nationality, and, worst of all, recollected that horrible tale anent the Marquis de Saint-Cyr, which in England no one had credited for the sake of Sir Percy as well as for her own.
"What? Still dreaming and staring?" she said with a merry laugh. "You are most ungallant, Sir Andrew, and now I come to think of it, you seemed more startled than pleased when you saw me just now. I do believe, after all, that it was not concern for my health, nor yet a remedy taught you by your grandmother that caused you to burn this tiny scrap of paper. I vow it must have been your lady-love's last cruel epistle you were trying to destroy. And now confess," she added playfully, holding up the scrap of paper, "does this contain her final congé, or her last appeal to kiss and make friends?"
"Whichever it is, Lady Blakeney," said Sir Andrew, who was gradually recovering his self-possession, "this little note is undoubtedly mine, and," not caring whether his action was one that would be styled ill-bred towards a lady, the young man had made a bold dash for the note. But Marguerite's thoughts flew quicker than his own. Her actions, under pressure of this intense excitement, were swifter and more sure. She was tall and strong. She took a quick step backwards and knocked over the small Sheraton table, which was already top-heavy, and which fell down with a crash, together with the massive candelabra upon it. She gave a quick cry of alarm.
"The candles, Sir Andrew, quick!"
There was not much damage done. One or two of the candles had blown out as the candelabra fell. Others had merely sent some grease upon the valuable carpet. One had ignited the paper shade over it. Sir Andrew quickly and dexterously put out the flames and replaced the candelabra upon the table. But this had taken him a few seconds to do, and those seconds had been all that Marguerite needed to cast a quick glance at the paper and to note its contents. A dozen words in the same distorted handwriting she had seen before, and bearing the same device, a star-shaped flower drawn in red ink. When Sir Andrew once more looked at her, he only saw on her face alarm at the untoward accident and relief at its happy issue, whilst the tiny and momentous note had apparently fluttered to the ground. Eagerly the young man picked it up, and his face looked much relieved as his fingers closed tightly over it. "For shame, Sir Andrew," she said, shaking her head with a playful sigh, "making havoc in the heart of some impressionable duchess whilst conquering the affections of my sweet little Suzanne. Well, well, I do believe it was Cupid himself who stood by you and threatened the entire Foreign Office with destruction by fire, just on purpose to make me drop love's message before it had been polluted by my indiscreet eyes. To think that a moment longer and I might have known the secrets of an erring duchess." "You will forgive me, Lady Blakeney," said Sir Andrew, now as calm as she was herself, "if I resume the interesting occupation which you had interrupted?"
"By all means, Sir Andrew. How should I venture to thwart the love god again? Perhaps he would mete out some terrible chastisement against my presumption. Burn your love token by all means."
Sir Andrew had already twisted the paper into a long spill, and was once again holding it to the flame of the candle, which had remained alight. He did not notice the strange smile on the face of his fair vis-à-vis, so intent was he on the work of destruction. Perhaps, had he done so, the look of relief would have faded from his face. He watched the fateful note as it curled under the flame. Soon the last fragment fell on the floor, and he placed his heel upon the ashes.
And now, Sir Andrew, said Marguerite Blakeney, with the pretty nonchalance peculiar to herself, and with the most winning of smiles, will you venture to excite the jealousy of your fair lady by asking me to dance the minuet?